And we are back with episode 699 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and GCBS, that's an awfully big hole you have on Tuesday nights at 10.
How did I know that you were going to point that out right off the bat? Well, some things are slightly predictable. Other things not so much, as some of the news items that we're going to have here this evening. Although we don't have a whole lot of news, so who knows? We may actually get into some other topics and some of the episodic discussion. So that being the case, Edmund, if you could give a disclaimer.
Absolutely. Our goal here is always to spoil you silly if you haven't been up on the news or up on the episodes. It might be a good thing one way. It might be not so good the other if you haven't watched the episodes we talk about.
That's right. That's right. And we are going to go ahead and get started with, as I said, a little bit of news. And this news comes out of... out of video game land, I guess you could say. The game Mirror's Edge is apparently headed to the small screen. According to Deadline, Endemol Shine Studios will be adapting the video game for television. A dystopian thriller, Mirror's Edge takes place in the future where couriers called runners take up the dangerous job of transporting messages without tipping government surveillance. The story follows a runner named Faith, who inadvertently becomes involved in a conspiracy against conglomerate government, which could end society as she knows it. Sharon Hall, the president of the studio, says, "We clearly see Mirror's Edge as a franchise for the global TV audience. It has a strong female protagonist, a wildly rabid fan base, and a worldwide brand that Electronic Arts and EA DICE have done an amazing job establishing." So the game was originally released back in 2007. There is a reboot, actually, called Mirror's Edge Catalyst, debuting on the 7th of June. So by the time this comes out, you might actually be within very short time span of it being released, that reboot. Not a game that I have played because it is a parkour game that is first person. So, well, it does kind of touch on in that Assassin's Creed world. It's first person, which means that I would feel violently ill within 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So that's not going to happen. But interesting that a property that was kind of seen as a one-off, most likely back in 2007, is now almost 10 years later, maybe becoming a franchise.
Yeah, and it kind of intrigues me. I mean, certainly, you know, not being a gamer like you, it's not something I'd heard of. But their mention of there being a female protagonist, I do wonder how much they're hoping to sort of piggyback on whatever success Ghost in the Shell is going to have.
That is true. You never know if that is something that they have in the back of their mind. All right, let's see. Next up on the list, Edmund.
Yes.
I'm sure that this is something that you want to get into just a little bit.
Just a little bit. I think we'd already reported on this, but the fact that Limitless, the CBS series that had replaced Person of Interest in the lineup on Tuesdays at 10, it was sort of left in limbo after the upfronts. They were talking about it wasn't definitively canceled, but they were looking to try and shop it to other outlets or streaming services, etc. That was as of last week, and it has now been officially canceled. The irony of the fact that CBS was actually willing to shop Limitless around, since it was their own property, and was not willing to do that for Person of Interest. Although, as has now been firmly established, Les Moonves is actually the president of CBS, has actually come out and said that basically, yes, Person of Interest being a property of Warner Brothers and not of CBS, basically didn't make them any money off of any ancillary rights, and that was a major reason why they did cancel it. But it does seem rather ironic now that even their own show they weren't able to quite keep it alive as much as the rabid Person of Interest fan base was, of course, urging them to at least cut Person of Interest loose quickly enough so that it possibly could have picked up one of those alternate streams. But sadly, it looks like for fans of both shows, we just have to make do with what we've got.
I suppose we will, but there is a certain irony, as you said, in Limitless being cut loose like this. I don't know is there a certain feeling? I kind of don't want to say satisfaction because I remember back when Dark Angel was canceled and Firefly took that spot. on the schedule. And there were all these fans of Dark Angel that were just openly wanting Firefly to fail because it, quote unquote, took their spot.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't want to be that fan, right?
I mean, the irony is that, you know, yes, you know, even though, yes, I was that person at the beginning of the season who, you know, I did not watch Limitless. You know, I was kind of, you know, hoping it would die an early death so Person of Interest could be slotted in because given their production schedule, I mean, they were already putting episodes in the can, you know, that could have been used in the fall season. The irony is, from what I've heard from friends and write-ups of the show, had a bit of a shaky start, but then was actually rounding out into a rather interesting show, and one that, if in fact it was going to continue, you know, I might have picked up over the summer and caught up in the episodes. But now, unfortunately, it just does not seem worth the effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an accurate way of putting it. All right, let's see here. Next on the list, we have some news out of cable and talking about shows that are not coming back. This next one is from A&E. They have decided to cancel the show Damien after one season. Apparently, the series that mashed up Insidious new action with footage of the original classic horror film did not go over so well. So, as the creator showrunner wrote on Twitter, "This hurts to say, but Damien will not be getting a second season. Thank you from all of us to our amazing fans. I really loved making Damien. We all did. We just never got the numbers there. Give it our best shot." I'm trying to see. This is a really awkwardly written. Yes, I think it doesn't say who the showrunner is until later, and then it's referring to him. So
yes.
There we go. I'm rolling with it. Damien was the first show Mazzara, whoever that may be, has done.
I believe that's Glenn Mazzara, if I'm remembering right. Even though, yeah, they don't seem to want to mention his first name anywhere in this article.
No. Maybe not. I don't know why. But anyway, so it's the first show he's done since ending his 2-year stint at The Walking Dead in 2013. He was also executive producer for The Shield and Crash. Wow, they really needed an editor on this article.
Yes, they did.
Holy cow. Anyway, yes, there's all kinds of errors in here, which is actually kind of interesting. I think I just found myself a new job. Wow. This is interesting. What it says here is that Damien was originally developed for Lifetime.
Yeah. Lifetime has been doing some more original dramas, but I could not really see Damien fitting into to their demographic. So it's not surprising it wound up in A&E, and certainly the A&E seeing it as a companion to Bates Motel, I mean, makes, you know, certainly on paper made a lot of sense. But I know, I mean, I think we certainly did report on the series getting developed, but it really did just seem to drop with a thud. I mean, I heard absolutely no buzz about this whatsoever. I certainly wasn't even aware that they were actually mashing up new footage with footage from the original Omen, which just sounds bizarre to me.
Hmm.
I presume it was flashbacks, since I got the impression that it was sort of, you know, it was following the more adult Damien, as he has developed since then. An odd little concept.
Yes, indeed. Yes, it the whole idea that they were interspersing stuff was kind of weird to me. But anyway, much better news, kind of. Well, I see it as better news.
Oh, much better news. Yes. Yeah, this almost made the teaser at the opening, but no, this is news about the Americans. It has in fact been renewed, and not just renewed, but renewed for a final two seasons. We will get a 13-episode fifth season in 2017, and then a 10-episode sixth and final season in 2018. In addition to that, show creators Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields have also signed deals with FX Productions to develop other new projects for the network. This is kind of following on from FX. The head of FX has been rather vocal in the last few months about his support for the show, and I really see this as just following through on even though it does, you know, this is a classic sort of old school case of even though it's a show that does not get huge ratings for the network, it does get them, considerable prestige and critical buzz, if not awards buzz yet, but we are hoping that might change in the next couple of years. It's great that they are giving the producers and writers and cast the security to finish off the series as they wish to. The two J's, as they're known, the producers, been very upfront about feeling that they have maybe a season or two of story to go, it's just really really nice. And of all that we talk about in terms of shows getting stretched for budget and running into the various financial hurdles to have a network step up and actually give a good show its due and let it go out on its own terms.
Yeah, I think that that's the important part of this, is that this is not some kind of abrupt cancellation. This is about really, like you said, letting them go out on their own terms. And that is the key here.
Yep.
All right, let's see. Next, we have some news out of HBO. And it's been a while since we said anything about this. But we have news that despite a production shutdown and serious doubts, it's now been assured that HBO's ambitious Westworld will air sometime this fall. Sometime.
Okay.
The cable network confirmed as much the afternoon this article was written, with an announcement trumpeting the 10-episode dark odyssey about the dawn of artificial consciousness and the evolution of sin. Mm. Yes, inspired by the 1973 film of the same name by Michael Crichton, the sci-fi thriller is created by Jonathan Nolan.
Yes.
Good name there. And mm-hmm. Lisa Joy, who serve as executive producers alongside J.J. Abrams and Brian Burke. And if these names are of any interest or sound familiar to any of you, it's because person of interest
yes.
had many of these names attached to it. Gee, artificial consciousness. Mm-hmm. Anyway, HBO describes the series as set at the intersection of the near future and the reimagined past. It explores a world in which every human appetite, no matter how noble or depraved, can be indulged. Yes, and of course, we have reported before that there was some controversy about some of what might show up on the show, but anyone who's familiar with the original film knows that it was pushing some boundaries even back then.
Absolutely.
Yes. So that being the case, look for that in the fall if you're interested in seeing what a modern take on that concept might be. And moving on over to alternative networks, or at least online anyway.
Yes. We have some news about Sense8, the Netflix original series. Of course, created and co-produced by the Wachowskis and J. Michael Straczynski. The Wrap has reported, or was the first to report, that Lily Wachowski has left the second season. Lana Wachowski is remaining on board. However, this does not appear to be a case of creative differences or anything, but more fallout from Lily Wachowski coming out, or actually kind of being forced prematurely to come out as transgender. And the initial report indicates that she is just taking some time off to focus on her well-being, with the option to potentially return for a third season if in fact Netflix renews it and it gets a third season. She will still be involved in the production, but taking a backseat, but still active as a co-creator. Interesting news, but certainly makes sense given all of the press and notoriety that outing occasioned. What I'm finding a little more intriguing is that was not the only departure for this coming season. Last month, Amal Amin, who plays Kafias, also left the series early in the production of season two over creative differences. He is naturally one of the core eight characters, they did not write him out, but just recast him with actor Toby Onwumere. Season two will continue with these shifts, and expected to premiere in 2017, but apparently there may be a Christmas special later this year, one would presume sometime in December. I will be looking forward to that, and I'm looking forward to this second season of this rather strange and wonderful show.
Yes, I need to catch up on it a little bit, but I am definitely interested in it for sure. Where it goes in the next season. Let's see. Next on our list, we have some news. Now, this is really interesting. There is something called Stephen King's Mr. Mercedes.
Hmm.
And it's heading to something called the Audience Network.
Yes, from AT&T. A joint venture between AT&T and DirecTV. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, that's the part that's interesting me. So, because I'd never heard of the Audience Network before, but apparently they've ordered Mr. Mercedes, an adaptation of Stephen King's 2014 hard-boiled detective novel from David E. Kelley. According to The Hollywood Reporter, Brendan Gleeson and Anton Yelchin will be starring in the 10-episode series set to premiere in 2018 on DirecTV and AT&T UVerse. So this seems like some kind of unusual, on phone network type of thing.
Yeah, I'm aware of this whole thing. You know, AT&T and DirecTV, you know, have we're basically brought together. So I guess, I mean, this is more a case of, you know, not necessarily a streaming network, you know, but a platform specific network. Where you have to be on UVerse or DirecTV to get access to it.
Yeah, it's throwing me off a little bit, but apparently, okay. Let for those who are interested, because I don't even know if this would be something that I would even be able to find, let alone watch. But yeah. Okay, Mr. Mercedes centers on a demented killer. Oh, that's always a good start.
Of course.
Who taunts a retired police detective with a series of lurid letter and emails, spurring him to launch a private and potentially illegal crusade to bring the murderer to justice before he can strike again. Gleason will star as Detective Bill Hodges, while Yelchin will play Brady Hartsfield, a mentally deranged ice cream truck driver and IT worker who's secretly the Mercedes killer. Okay, now the thing is that this actually sounds interesting.
Yes.
It's got kind of that whole Zodiac killer vibe going to it.
Definitely.
Wow, okay. So, I guess David E. Kelley is going to be writing the first episode and serving as showrunner. And he's also going to be an executive producer alongside Jack Bender, who has worked on things such as Under the Dome with Stephen King. But Jack Bender is well known for, directing things in just about every show I can think of that I've enjoyed. Certainly, he had a long tenure on Lost.
Absolutely, yep.
I'm trying to remember. He just recently did... why can't I think of it? But he just did. He was the director for episodes of a show. I know that we gave it high marks. I think it might have actually been Game of Thrones that he may have been involved in, the episode that we're actually going to talk about this week.
Yes.
So
yeah, that I was thinking. I had seen his name pop up too, and I think you're right.
That is in fact what I was thinking of, because yes. I just went to the page for we're going to talk about it later, and it's right there.
Okay.
So see, it eventually kind of comes to mind. All right, let's see here. I'm a little bit wary of whether or not this is going to be one of those shows that falls through the cracks, because I'm thinking that DirecTV actually has tried to get into the whole game with Netflix and Amazon and mm-hmm. Hulu and some of these others, where they're trying to do these original productions. And
right.
I know that I think you've seen a couple of them.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to make it, because I think that's where Damages wound up, I think, for its final season. But I believe that was before the merger with AT&T, or them being bought by AT&T. So I guess the hope is that it might get a little bit more traction coverage through that. But still being tied to just specific providers like that, I still think it's going to be a hard road to hoe to really get the viewership they need.
Yeah, but it's interesting, the talent behind it. That's the thing that's kind of surprising me. And then I'm thinking of, we've seen other online things like Crackle trying to kind of jump into this whole arena as well. And I'm just thinking to myself, even if there's something that I'm really interested in along those lines, I kind of start forgetting that they exist. So... Yes. It's one of those things where if you're not a big name when it comes to these alternative networks, these online networks, you could have a great show, you could have a great premise, and you could even have great people behind it, and it could wind up being completely overlooked. But be that as it may. what do we have next? Next on the list, we have some movie news.
Yes. I think we had actually reported on this more as rumor, but this is Warner Brothers has officially announced that a live-action film adaptation of Hiromu Arakawa's Full Metal Alchemist is in the works, slated to premiere in Japan in winter 2017. Filming is scheduled to begin in Italy at the beginning of June. We'll wrap up in Japan at the end of August. So shooting through this summer, starring Ryosuke Yamada, who is a member of Heisei Jump, one of those Japanese pop bands. He will be Edward Elric. Tsubasa Hondo is cast as Winry Rockbell, and Dean Fujioka as Roy Mustang. Yes, they do have a director, naturally, Fumihiko Sori, who directed the live-action Ping Pong, and he said on adapting the source material, "I want to create a style that follows the original manga as much as possible. The cast is entirely Japanese, but the cultural background is Europe," hence the filming in Italy. "However, it's a style that does not represent a specific race or country." Sori also said he could not yet reveal details on how Alphonse will be presented in the film, but is confident fans will be satisfied. And for those who are not familiar with the story, Full Metal Alchemist details when an alchemical ritual has gone wrong. Edward Elric has lost his arm and leg, and his brother Alphonse has become nothing but a soul in a suit of armor. Equipped with mechanical automail limbs, Edward becomes a state alchemist, seeking the one thing that can restore his and his brother's body, the legendary Philosopher's Stone. may sound familiar to some Harry Potter fans, but in a completely different context. And of course, this manga has already been adapted for television, an anime series in 2013, also a movie in 2005, a couple of other spin-offs as well. The original anime, I've not gotten all the way through it. I have watched a bunch of the episodes, and did enjoy it quite a bit. So I am rather intrigued, given some of the live action adaptations that have gone on recently, like perhaps one should say tongue-in-cheek one for Attack on Titan. It certainly sounds like this time they are going for a more straight-up adaptation, and I think this one could be quite a bit of fun.
Yeah, it definitely is one of those that I've been told I should look into, that it's better than it seems at first, because yes. I had a hard time reading the manga getting into it. Although apparently there are other members of the family that certainly seem to be more inclined towards it. And I've heard many good things about Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, which is one of the anime adaptations. I have also heard quite a few concerns about this adaptation for live action, because it just doesn't seem like it's the kind of thing that would necessarily lend itself to that kind of adaptation. But that having been said... Well, I guess we'll find out in the fullness of time. But let's see here. That having been the case, sorry, my computer was not letting me get back to my notes.
Mm-hmm.
How inconvenient. And probably for the good of my sanity. Let's see here. James Franco has a film called Future World, and a post-apocalyptic thriller, and it is apparently going to be, this should probably be in casting news, but whatever. Lucy Liu, Suki Waterhouse, and Snoop Dogg are joining James Franco on this thriller. This is going to be co-directed, which is rather unusual for there to be a co-director on things, it's also going to have Mila Jovovich, Method Man, and a few others. Future World is based on an original story by James Franco, set in the barren landscape of a dystopian world where a young prince from the Oasis, one of the last known safe havens, and a robot named Ash go on a daring journey of self-discovery through the violent and desolate world of the wastelands. This feels like somebody trying to take some of these really unusual 1970s sci-fi films and making a modern version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like a boy and his dog comes to mind.
A boy and his dog. I mean, not to mention that recent AMC series Into the Wastelands.
Yes, right. Into the Badlands, rather.
Oh, Badlands, I'm Badlands. Sorry. Yes,
but, which I guess would be distinguished by the fact that it has a better cast and that kind of Asian action film styling. But mm-hmm. yeah, this just seems really unusual. I don't know. There's something about this that I'm just curious as to exactly. So I guess there's here's a blurb from somebody, I guess the group that is going to be financing the film. Future World is a mesmerizing story with the kind of boundary-pushing creativity unique to James Franco. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you have the combined talents and gravitas of Mila, Lucy, Method Man, Suki, Snoop, and James interwoven woven through a wild story, what unfolds on the screen is unreal. Now that, I believe.
Yeah, that sounds very accurate.
Very, very crazy. Yes, so, yeah, the... Believe it or not, I'm more intrigued the more I read in this article. This feels like that movie Southland Tales, which had this amazing cast and was a complete and utter disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So this just feels like James Franco in a kind of a personal project.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
so as Bronstein would say, this should be about 3.5 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Any other thoughts on this film?
Have the fast forward button ready.
Yes. Speaking of fast forward, unfortunately, we slipped right into casting news before I realized we were going that far. So belatedly, there we are. And Edmund, if you could take the next one.
Certainly. We have casting news for the upcoming Dirk Gently series. According to Deadline, joining Samuel Barnett, Hannah Marks, and Elijah Wood are Neil Brown Jr., who will be playing Estevez, Richard Schiff from The West Wing, among others, of course, as Zimmerfield, Jade Ashett as Farah Black, Mafo Kawahu as Ken, Fiona Dourif as Bart Kurlish, Michael Eklund as Martin, Miguel Sandoval as Colonel Scott Riggins, Dustin Milligan as Sergeant Hugo Friedkin, and Aaron Douglas from Battlestar Galactica, of course, as Gordon Rimmer. So it sounds like, yeah, they have completely filled out their cast. Yeah, we just the way they are currently characterizing it, Dirk Gently's holistic detective agency is a comedic thriller that follows the bizarre adventures of eccentric detective Dirk Gently and his reluctant assistant Todd as they work their way through one big, seemingly insane mystery. And this will be 8 episodes when we get it. And no, I do not see a release date mentioned here. So sometime next year, I believe.
This would be the Max Landis Dirk Gently property?
Yes.
Okay, yes. I'm catching up on my comic book reading. I was going to mention this later in the week or sometime this week anyway. And one of the ones that I am catching up on is Dirk Gently's A Spoon Too Far, I believe it is called. And it actually is set between the original Holistic Detective Agency adaptation, and it explicitly states in there that it is a prequel to the new adaptation.
Ah, okay.
So for those who are wondering, yes, it definitely has that flair. I enjoy, I've only read the first issue of it so far because I am a little bit behind, but it does definitely hit all the right buttons. So go out and find that if you can. I think it's still ongoing. I don't think that it is finished up quite yet.
Yeah, that sounds quite intriguing.
Okay. I'm just checking on something here. I believe you have the next one as well.
I do. Yes. Speaking of Ghost in the Shell, which I referenced earlier, after all of the complaints about whitewashing in the cast casting, we now have word that Ryla Fukushima, who most notably starred in The Wolverine, playing the mutant Yukio, will be joining Scarlett Johansson and the rest of the cast. Michael Pitt, Juliette Binoche. They have at least added one Asian actor to the previously entirely Caucasian cast. So not this is necessarily going to mollify all of the complaints, yes, some might even say it almost smacks of tokenism, but yes, they have in fact finally cast an Asian actor.
I don't think it's tokenism. I don't think that's where people are going to go with this. I think that people are going to be annoyed because they're going to say, well, why didn't you cast Fukushima as the main character?
Well, yes, exactly.
That's what they're going to say. In fact, they already are saying it. When I saw that she had been cast for the film, that was the first thought that went through my mind was nothing against Johansson. I think that she'll be fine. But I was just thinking to myself, I remember when I was watching The Wolverine that I thought that she was, you know, a very distinctive looking and talented actress, and it actually was one of the people that came to mind when I heard that they were adapting Ghost in the Shell. So yeah, I have to put my name slightly reluctantly into that hat because I don't like to go necessarily in that direction in criticism with the casting and such. But yeah, wow, okay. Way to really put a nice spotlight on the casting controversy.
Yes.
Wow. Something that's a little less controversial, I suppose, is some news about casting for this third season of The Flash. Already we are being told that Tom Cavanaugh is going to be confirmed as a series regular.
Yes.
Now, this is kind of weird because in the first season, he was Harrison Wells, otherwise known as Eobard Thawne. And then in the second season, he was the Harry Wells from Earth 2,
yes.
Who then, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But
oh, I'm sure.
Let's just say his story seemed to come to a fairly logical end.
Mm-hmm.
So who is Tom Cavanaugh going to play in the third season?
Yes, we will be getting into it, but yes, that was before Barry decided to scramble everything.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose, but it is kind of unusual that this is the way that they are choosing to go. It almost makes me feel like, is this going to be like a Grant Ward situation where they kill off character? No, he's back.
Yeah,
okay.
I suspect he's going for the Guinness World Record for the number of times the same actor can play different characters on a TV series.
Yes, all name the same thing.
Yeah.
Of course. Well, now, wait. So the first season he was playing the Harry Wells from Earth 1.
Well.
Presumably. Or Earth.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So in the second season he was playing Harry Wells from Earth 2.
Yeah.
And progression seems to be forming.
Yes. Well, Earth 3 did get name checked. So.
It did. It got name checked and it got kind of referenced to a certain extent in Legends of Tomorrow as well. I mean, for those who are up on their JSA history or continuity, and the fact that Earth 3 seems to be more like the Earth 2 of the comics, from what I understand. Gary would have to help with that a little bit if he is able to join us in a bit. But let's just say that there are it's a multiverse out there.
Mm-hmm.
And Barry's making things even more complicated. So it may be that Tom Cavanaugh is going to have plenty of opportunity to play Harry Wells.
Yes.
Again, a different type. I don't know. It's so confusing. But in a good way, mostly. All right. And that means that we have one last bit of casting news here.
This is news about Alita Battle... Battle Angel. Yes, they did get it slightly wrong in the opening sentence here. Mm-hmm. But Alita Battle Angel coming to us from courtesy of James Cameron and Robert Rodriguez. Apparently, this hasn't been officially confirmed, but Collider is reporting that of the four potential leads, the decision has been made, and it has come down to Rosa Salazar, who most recently was in Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials, and this was just following on from that report. There were four actresses in the running, and apparently Rosa Salazar has come out on top. This is a project that for years James Cameron was going to direct, but now that he is completely tied up in Avatar 2, 3, 5, 7, 9, whatever he finally comes up with. So now Robert Rodriguez will be stepping in to direct. James Cameron said in a statement back when Rodriguez was announced last October, Robert and I have been looking for a film to do together for years, so I was pumped when he said he wanted to do Battle Angel. Very collaborative. We're already like two kids building a go-kart, just having fun, riffing creatively and technically. Project is near and dear to me, and there's nobody I trust more than Robert with his technical virtuosity and rebel style to take over the directing reins. We're looking forward to learning a lot from each other while we make a kick-ass epic. So no release date yet announced, look, at some point we may be seeing Alita Battle Angel.
Yes, it would actually be really cool if that were to happen. All right, let's see here. that is it, actually, for our news segment. And how about how far are we into this recording?
We are about 40 minutes in.
Okay, well, then it seems like we should probably move over into the episodic discussion and probably just to focus on the bottom three.
Absolutely.
And that should be able to get us through this first show of the week. Yeah, and I think that, yeah, just give, you know, our usual disclaimer yet again. Just for those
certainly. Yeah, as we get into episodic discussion, we will discuss whatever we feel like might have happened in these episodes. So if you haven't seen them, yes, you will be spoiled.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So we are going to start with the first of our bottom three, and all of these episodes are still above average. So there is that to be said for them, but just happened to be the bottom three. And let's see, the first one here, not too surprising that this should be the case, but Preacher, Season 1, Episode 1, Pilot. In the series premiere, Jesse struggles to escape a past that is slowly catching up to him. Meanwhile, a mysterious entity comes to Earth, leaving a wave of destruction in its wake.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. And this one came in at an average of 7.25, and I mean... I gave it a 7.5. That's well above what I usually give a pilot. I thought it was a pretty decent start, but I think it's going to take a little getting used to.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly, you know, I mean, this is one of the crazier hours of television, or, well, hour and a half of television, for this pilot, you know, that I've seen in a while. I mean, I gave it a 7, as much because, while, I mean, you know, there was a lot of, very intriguing and madcap stuff going on. It was definitely, you know, a case of them sort of throwing all of these events up at the screen, and I don't think you were meant to really be making any sense of it yet. It was just more introducing all of these crazy characters and bizarre situations, and as we mentioned in Into the Badlands previously. I mean, this was sort of taking some of that over-the-top violence and just going even further with it. So I was certainly entertained, but certainly there's sort of a reserving of judgment until they start bringing some of these pieces together. But from having crazy fights on airplanes with some sort of supernatural being who can jump out of planes and summon fire from his hands, Dominic Cooper's shady past and decision to return and for whatever strange reason decide to try and be a preacher, and certainly after really enjoying Ruth Negga's work on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I am really happy to see her get a chance to take a really fun, bizarre, meaty role and have her way with it. A very interesting start, and I'm definitely intrigued to see how all this hangs together, since this is not a book that I was familiar with in its original comics run. So from what I've seen so far, I think this is a case where I may go back to the comics at some point after this has had its run, but I think I want to see if they can actually bring all this together in the adaptation before I dip my toes into the original.
Hmm. Yeah. I guess for me the performances were fine, and I guess it's just trying to get used to the characters a little bit. I feel like it was trying to get a tone across more than it was really the meat of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why I was kind of like, I like the tone of it. It's very unusual, but I'm a little bit less sure that I understand the characters just yet. Or even the world that they're in. It's just kind of, we're thrown almost in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, and I'm sure it'll kind of gel eventually. All right. Next on the list we have, surprisingly, Arrow, Season 4, Episode 22, Lost in the Flood. Oliver and Diggle race to rescue Theo while Felicity, Curtis, and Noah join together to stop Dark. And this came in at an average of 7.13. And a big part of that is Nadim's score of 6.5. And he puts it pretty bluntly, although this had some action-packed visuals, this was a borderline laughable hour of Arrow. Ooh, yes. And honestly, for me, it was the fact that so much time was spent in this episode on the flashbacks that it kind of made it hard for me to engage because I haven't cared about the flashbacks at all this season.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I was mentioning last week. I mean, you know, the way they were using the flashbacks to supposedly sort of give more background on the supernatural and magical nature of things going on this season. It's just felt just completely superfluous, you know, and unnecessary. I mean, you know, we in terms of what we've been learning from Dark himself and certainly a little bit of background via Constantine in recent episodes. I just haven't seen any reason why we needed to be why he needed to be back on the island. And if anything, it was more bringing up the point of, you know, okay, so you know why was he seeming sort of in the dark about this stuff early on in the season when you've been telling us how he's already run up against something like this before. So some real sort of storytelling dissonance going on between present day and flashbacks this time around.
Yeah, it's honestly the thing that bothers me here with Arrow right now in this season, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more when we talk about the finale next week. The flashbacks really haven't been working for me for two seasons now. It worked fairly well in the second season with the whole background with Slade Wilson and with Deathstroke and all of that, where it kind of showed that, yes, they can do more than what they did with the initial flashbacks in the first season in trying to at least introduce the idea of the island and everything else. And it seems like since then they have been struggling to find relevant material. And yeah. I'm still not convinced that the material on the island is at all relevant to what's going on in the modern day. Other than the fact that it was another time in Oliver's life where he happened to deal with magic. And that's it. I mean, it's tangential in many respects. I'm sure that, you know, if I were paying more attention to the flashbacks, I might know that there were more connections there. But guess what? The writers haven't given me reason to.
So, yeah, I mean, part of it seems to, I mean, it seems to me that you know, I mean, when they had him get off the island, and then it was like they had to come up with you know, some reason to get him back on the island, and that whole storytelling process just wound up being a little too contrived and tortured. To just to have him back on Leon Yu, for the sake of this plot device that they'd created, and to try and explain why he was away for a full 5 years, when he managed to get off of managed to get away after two, so
yeah.
And and ironically, I mean, in terms of the story that they developed in the present day, I mean, I think, you know, it was actually, you know, more than enough to keep the interest. This whole idea of even though I still think of it as Wayward Pines, but certainly running into that family that hadn't taken the pills, weren't being coerced, but it seemed perfectly reasonable given all that's happened in Star City for them to say, it's like, this city has been, you know, close to a shambles for the past 3 years, we were happy to be in this nice, nice, controlled state, stable environment, and get away from all this stuff that's been going on with the Arrow and the Dark Archer and Malcolm Merlyn and etc. That seemed rather sensible to me.
Yeah, it's, I'm just hoping that they find a way to make it relevant for the last year, that the flashbacks make sense. But you'd think that at some point Oliver would sit back and say, hey, you know, it's really kind of unusual, but my current life is eerily similar to the progression of things that happened starting with when I wound up on that damn island.
Yes.
Maybe I can use that as a means of predicting what is going to happen to me in the future.
And honestly, I mean the other thing that kind of got to me, I mean, for this is the, you know, as the penultimate episode, the setup for the finale, there was something about that ending with Dark just bursting into the condo and, you know, and saying, you know, oh, you know, you know, no, you know, now I'm going to, you know, it, make you do my bidding that just felt rather contrived as well. I was sort of taken aback because given the way they were having the CW is having certain shows with finales and certain shows with penultimate episodes. Actually, for a while, as they were coming to the end of this, you know, I was thinking that this was the finale, and then Dark came rushing in. And it's like, oh, okay, no, you're still just sort of setting things up for the finale, it was just all feeling a little bit disjointed to me.
Yeah, but I feel like that's been the case for pretty much this entire the season, especially ever since Black Canary was taken out.
Mm-hmm.
It's just felt like something's missing out of this whole thing. But anyway, it's felt disjointed, I guess, is the way that it goes. And we've noticed this, or we've seen this. It's kind of made itself apparent by the fact that you have 2 weeks in a row, at least, that Arrow has wound up in the bottom three.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. Something worth noting, I guess. All right, then, moving on to the bottom show for the week, and that is Hunters, Season 1, Episode 7, Kissing the Machine. The Hunters attempt to reprogram a captive Regan. While the ETU work to locate their missing agent, they deal with the possibility that there could be a mole in their ranks. And we are going to be giving this one a 7. I say we, I mean me. And I'm going to have to say that I'm calling it for this show, which is kind of unusual for me. I think, Edmund, you can attest, I yes. usually don't give up on shows that easily.
Yep, absolutely.
But I've given this half a season, and I just can't get into it.
Mm-hmm.
There is something about this show that is just dreadfully just missing anything of that's grabbing me. I really don't know how better to put it. It's not necessarily boring, but it's just after I've watched an episode, I can't think of anything that really is grabbing me or sticking. I'll watch it, and then you could easily ask me, so what just happened? And I just shrug. I'm not engaged at all in this show, which is very unfortunate because, again, Gail Ann Hurd, I believe is her name, from The Walking Dead, is involved mm-hmm. in this, and you'd think that she would be able to deliver the goods again. But I don't know. I guess it was just missing this time. But yeah, this show is not necessarily the lowest rated show or scored show on our list this year, but it is definitely down towards the bottom. And yeah, I gave it my best chance here. But yeah, it's just not going to be reviewed going forward. So I hope that those that enjoy the show continue to do so, but I really just can't muster up the enthusiasm for it any longer. It's unfortunate, but there we are. That's it for the bottom three, and what we're going to go ahead and do is wrap up this episode here. When we come back next time, we're going to do our top three and as many episodes for the rest of the week as we can get into the hour. So until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.